Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading from the Big Bend Sentinel. Coronavirus live updates for the Big Bend region by Abby Perot, Steve Polson. Last updated, June 25th, 4:22 p.m., read by Melanie. In an announcement on Thursday, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said he was putting the state's reopening plans on temporary pause due to increased coronavirus case counts and hospitalizations. The last thing we want to do as a state is go backwards and close down businesses, he said, urging Texans to wear masks, wash their hands regularly, and practice social distancing. The latest testing data from the Texas Department of State Health Services, Presidio County, 14 confirmed, including at least 2 recovered. Brewster County, 76, including at least 1 recovered. Jeff Davis County, 0 confirmed. Tri-County area physicians have said there are presumed positive cases in the region, as some cases, which doctors assume are coronavirus, are not being tested. Texas continues to be one of the worst-ranked states for testing per capita. Nearby counties' case counts: El Paso, 4,984; Hudspeth, 14; Culberson, 3; Reeves, 18; Pecos, 116; Terrell, 1; Ward, 11; Crane, 49; Ector, 43; Ector, 434; Midland, 494; Valverde, 85. At least 2,296 Texans have died from the virus. 1,331,917 have tested positive for COVID-19, and around 1.88 million people in the state have been tested. We are staying in regular contact with health authorities, schools, businesses, and other officials, and will update regularly with timestamps for time-sensitive updates. Here's what else we know. You can also use the links below to skip to the relevant section. As coronavirus case counts climb in Tri-County, Presidio braces for impact. By Stephen Paulson, June 24, 2020, read by Melanie. Presidio. The city of Presidio saw Presidio County's first coronavirus case in late May, when a female resident in her 40s was confirmed to have picked up the disease through travel. But as case counts pick up to the north and south, the border city is starting to look like a refuge, with time for just one travel-related coronavirus case. Unfortunately, that sense of relative safety is already starting to erode. On Tuesday, the Family Crisis Center of the Big Bend announced on social media that an employee in Presidio had tested positive, bringing the confirmed case count for Presidio City up to at least 2. Across the Rio Grande and Presidio's sister city of Ojinaga, Mexican officials recorded the first coronavirus case in April, and the case count is rising, hitting at least 39 by Wednesday. U.S. federal officials last week reimposed their bans on non-essential travelers from Mexico, and car crossings throughout the region have dropped 37%, according to data from Customs and Border Protection. But while Mexican border officials are reportedly taking temperatures of anyone entering the country, U.S. border officials are instead referring anyone with symptoms to local health officials and the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention for an enhanced health screening, a CBP spokesperson said. We are not healthcare workers and do not perform health screenings, he added. The situation isn't much better stateside, though. In Brewster County, and especially in Alpine, case counts have soared this week, going from just one case in early June to at least 61. Marfa's situation looks similar. Local officials earlier this month announced Marfa's first case, along with 4 family members classified as probable. Days later, they warned that the affected family was not respecting control measures and that, therefore, the probability exists of possible spread. At press time, there are at least 14 cases in Presidio County, according to the Department of State Health Services. As outbreaks pick up in the Tri-County, officials in Presidio have various theories for why the border city has so far stayed relatively safe. "I think you've got to attribute a little to luck," said the city administrator, Joe Portillo, but he stressed that he feels Presidio residents are acting responsibly. "I really think people are being pretty smart," he said. "Most people, not all but most, even though it's not required, most wear a mask when they go into the store." John Ferguson, the mayor of Presidio, said the same. "I know I've bragged about this over and over, but I think this town generally takes the mask thing pretty seriously," he said. "You still see a majority of people entering businesses wearing masks. Again, that's just a personal observation, but I think there's some truth in there." Presidio's more low-key reputation might also be helping. The Tri-County region is full of tourist hotspots, from Big Bend National Park to art galleries in Marfa and Terlingua. And while Presidio does get some visitors, especially people traveling to Big Bend Ranch State Park, their tourist numbers lag far below elsewhere in the region. "Ohinaga is similarly a tourist draw," Mayor Ferguson said. "People flock from across the region to visit Ohinaga, whether to see family or just get a taste of Mexico, but they rarely linger in Presidio." "They may stop at the gas station or the grocery store," Ferguson added, "but generally they're just trying to get straight into Mexico. There's probably not a lot of people circulating in Presidio." Presidio city officials have spent years trying to figure out how to better tap into the regional tourist industry, whether through festivals or other initiatives. Ironically, those low visitor numbers might now be doing the border city a favor. "Marfa and Presidio are two different animals," said Alci Tavares, mayor pro tem for the city, calling Marfa a mecca for the art industry. "And then there's the worst possibility. Perhaps Presidio officially has no cases simply because health officials haven't yet found one. After all, testing has been lagged throughout the region and state, and testing rates in Presidio have been so low that Melinda Richardson, EMS director for the city, has even proposed using a raffle to entice locals into getting tested." "People are not coming out for testing," Richardson said in a phone interview on Monday. "Are we really as safe as we think we are?" Regardless, if coronavirus does gain more of a foothold in the city of Presidio, the consequences could be serious. Around 25% of residents there are over the age of 65, and around 40% live at below the poverty line. Both are risk factors for serious complications from coronavirus. In part for those reasons, officials in the city have taken the virus seriously, imposing lockdowns and requiring masks in businesses. At one point, the city even barred non-essential visits. Then, in May, Governor Greg Abbott overturned those local rules as he stated he started his reopening plans for the state. City leaders were furious, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported. At the first city council meeting after the rule changes, Tavares said that the message of Governor Abbott's order was that state leadership doesn't give a crap about you. Other city leaders reacted similarly. "We are going to be casualties of war," Councilmember Antonio Manriquez said. "That's what the governor said. We're old. We're dispensable." A lot has changed since May, though. As Texas has reopened, case counts across the state have surged, including outbreaks in Marfa and Alpine. Texas cities like Houston have been slammed, with Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo warning earlier this month that the city was on the precipice of disaster. The Washington Post reported this week that just three states, Texas, Arizona, and Florida, are responsible for worsening case counts in the United States. Governor Abbott's directives have also changed. Though cities are still barred from requiring masks in general, last week San Antonio tried out a loophole. Nelson Wolf, the county judge for Behar County, imposed a new rule requiring not that people wear masks in businesses, but that businesses require their customers to wear masks. Observers expected a showdown between Behar County and the state, but instead, Governor Abbott told reporters that the new rules were authorized and the plan in place all along. Several cities and counties soon followed Behar County's lead, including Marfa last Thursday and Alpine on Tuesday. On Wednesday evening, after the Big Bend Sentinel went to press, Presidio leaders were expected to consider a similar ordinance. Behind the latest ordinance is Tavares. In an interview on Monday, he said he expects Presidio City Council to adopt the rules, noting that both city officials and residents appear to support such rules. "We were kind of handcuffed by the governor's executive order a few weeks ago," he said. "It looks like we've got that leeway to make that decision again, so I think we'll probably exercise it." Tavares said he is frustrated with the conflicting measures coming from the state. And for any residents who might oppose such rules, Tavares said he'd rather they cuss me out than get sick with coronavirus. "At least you're still alive," he added of those people. "One death is still too many." Marfa uses state-sanctioned loophole to mandate masks. By Abby Perot, June 24th, 2020. Read by Melanie. Marfa. The city of Marfa voted on Thursday to require businesses to mandate face coverings for employees and customers in any place where maintaining a constant 6 feet of distance is not possible. The city's ordinance stuck closely to the wording of Behar County's mask ordinance and passed unanimously in an emergency city council meeting on Thursday, June 18th. Earlier this year, Governor Greg Abbott prevented local governments from requiring its residents to wear a mask, essentially striking down orders like the one City of Presidio passed in April that said residents must wear masks in public. Then last week, Behar County Judge Nelson Wolf poked around and found a loophole in Governor Greg Abbott's executive orders, discovering that while local governments could not require their residents to wear masks, they could require local businesses to require masks. City Attorney Teresa Todd urged council at the emergency meeting to stick as closely to Behar County's ordinance. "We don't want to stray too far because this actually has the governor's blessing," she told Marfa's council at the evening Zoom meeting. Governor Abbott said Wolf finally figured it out and that requiring businesses to require masks was the plan all along, despite never indicating that loophole previously. "I don't believe that was his original intent," Todd said, noting that he is now coming under some heat as cases rapidly rise in many parts of the state and local governments feel powerless to implement controls. "As I think y'all know, it's been very frustrating for cities not to have any enforcement authority when it comes to masks, since it's been shown they do help prevent the spread of COVID," the attorney said. Governor Abbott has previously fought local governments who have put in ordinances that are stricter than his executive orders. His office warned Presidio County at the end of April that they could not keep hotels, motels, and short-term rentals closed as a precaution against the pandemic, indicating his orders superseded theirs. At the Thursday meeting, Councilmember Buck Johnson hoped to strike the part of the ordinance that implied masks weren't required if 6 feet of distance could be maintained, saying that it would just cause more people to act defiantly and challenge enforcement, making it harder for businesses to enforce the mask requirements. But council bristled, including Councilmember Raul Lara, who called the proposed ordinance an excellent start and urged council not to stray from it for fear that the whole ordinance would be struck down and once again no requirements would be in place. Justice of the Peace David Beebe spoke up to remind the council that any business owner can choose to be more strict than the ordinance because they have the right to set their own rules and refuse service to customers who didn't meet their requirements. Along with requiring face coverings for employees and customers, the ordinance has some reasonable exceptions. Children under 10 are not required to wear masks, nor those with written proof of a health issue. Masks are not required while exercising outside, driving alone, or with others in your household, while banking, as it interferes with security surveillance, while pumping gas, and importantly, while consuming food or drink. Masks are still required at food and drink establishments when entering or exiting the establishment or using facilities such as restrooms. "What we want is for the police department to be there to back these businesses up," Attorney Todd told the council. In Marfa, that could look like a business owner wearing a maskless warning a maskless person to put on a face covering or leave the premises. If they refuse, the police department could be called in to issue a criminal trespass warning. If the person attempted to return to the premises, they could face trespassing charges. It's on the business. The business has to tell them to put a mask on. If they get in their face, they won't leave. It can be a criminal trespass or, if they're worse, a disorderly conduct, said Marfa Police Chief Steve Marquez in an interview this week. It's not about whether the person is wearing a mask anymore. It's about whether they're engaged in criminal behavior, according to Todd. Under the order, it is businesses who can face penalties, though, not individuals. While individuals can be charged for unlawful actions that stemmed from enforcement of the order, businesses can face up to $1,000 fines for each day they do not require employees and customers to wear masks. So far, Marfa Police have had a couple of complaints about one business, and the city is working with its management to implement the mask requirements. The ordinance went into effect on Monday, and there is a 5-day grace period to work with these businesses to require masks. Additionally, the city is holding a workshop tonight at 5:30 p.m. on Zoom to discuss the ordinance, inviting the public to weigh in. On the night it passed, there were 9 cases of COVID-19 in Marfa, with 1 being contracted due to traveling out of the area, while 8 others were from the disease spreading within the community, often from unidentified sources. Those who have coronavirus are ordered by the Department of State Health Services to stay home and quarantine for 2 weeks while they recover, and until they can test negative for the virus. But face coverings are useful because some who have COVID-19 may not show any symptoms, but are still able to spread the disease to people who could be seriously harmed by contracting coronavirus. The cloth face cover is meant to protect other people in case you are infected. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention explains on their site. Because there is no vaccine, preventative measures are society's only defense against the pandemic spread. You could spread COVID-19 to others even if you do not feel sick. Everyone should wear a cloth face cover when they have to go out in public, for example, to the grocery store or to pick up other necessities, the CDC site says. Still, face covering isn't foolproof in preventing spread. Continue to keep about 6 feet between yourself and others. The cloth face cover is not a substitute for social distancing, the site reads. Mayor Manny Baeza urged council to pass it as is, speculating that there would be blowback from the state if Marfa chose to make the ordinance any stricter, and saying the city could tweak whatever needs to be fixed on this ordinance at the Thursday night workshop. We can do this little trial run and see what we need to modify. The public hearing and regular meeting will take place 5:30, and residents can dial in or watch online. Ballroom Stands with Black Lives Matter by Stephen Paulson, June 24th, 2020, read by Melanie. Marfa. Ballroom Marfa is taking a stand for the Black Lives Matter movement. With protests across the country over the death of George Floyd, one of the latest Black Americans to die at the hands of law enforcement, Ballroom announced earlier this month that it was donating $10,000 to racial justice causes. The donation was split between 4 organizations: Black Lives Matter, Color of Change, the Innocence Project of Texas, and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. In a lengthy social media post about the donation, Ballroom said it stands in solidarity with the movement for Black Lives and with all those working to dismantle systemic racism in this country. Violence against Black Americans and the systems that produce and perpetuate it have caused incalculable grief, terror, and physical suffering, the post continued. We cannot continue to live in a world like this. Then, on Friday, Juneteenth, an art piece went airborne over the ballroom courtyard. The piece was simple, a banner proclaiming Black Lives Matter connected to 2 black balloons. We wave this flag to commemorate Juneteenth, the liberation of enslaved African Americans in Galveston, Texas on June 19, 1865, explained another social media post from Ballroom. Let's remind ourselves that every Texan and American deserves absolute freedom, dignity, and respect. In an interview, Sarah Melendez, Programs Director for Ballroom, said the piece came together in about a week. 2 artists approached Ballroom to propose the piece, and the conversation was really easy, Melinda said. Ballroom was fully aligned with the goals of the project and quickly gave the go-ahead. The two artists behind the piece decided to remain anonymous. They didn't want to detract from the message, Melinda explained. They wanted the message to be centered around Black Lives Matter and not necessarily be about them or taking credit, she said. They just really wanted to allow the action to speak for itself. Ballroom staff and founders have been really moved by the recent demands for racial justice, Melinda said. Ballroom watched this year's protest movement gain steam across the country, including with the march in Alpine, which several Ballroom employees joined. The developments prompted conversations within Ballroom about what's happening in the world and how we could support the movement. Asked why this particular movement has had so much resonance for people. Why George Floyd and why now? Melinda cited a few factors. On the national level, I think it has to do with the sort of immense amount of pressure of our current culture and political climate, she said. People were isolated and frustrated due to coronavirus, and there was a growing awareness not only of injustice in general, but of how a lot of the people that have really been affected by the coronavirus are minorities and people of color. But while George Floyd's killing happened in Minneapolis, the movement had resonance across the country, including in the rural Big Bend. Melinda cited what she described as over-policing in the region. Marfa, she noted, is home to a range of local, state, and federal authorities, from the Presidio County Sheriff's Office to local offices for Border Patrol and the Texas Department of Public Safety. Taken together, all those ingredients were the perfect recipe for a movement, Melinda said. People are just really fired up. SRSU brings much-needed testing to Tri-County, but not without a hitch. By Stephen Paulson, June 24th, 2020. Read by Melanie. Tri-County. Last week, as coronavirus case counts in the Tri-County continued to climb and residents grew more concerned, Pete Gallego, the new president of Sul Ross University, put in a call to the office of Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Gallego, who previously served in both the U.S. and Texas House of Representatives, hoped to ramp up testing in the region, and his call paid off. I have to tell you, the governor's office was extremely helpful, Gallego said. Within 24 hours of my call, we had a team on the ground. So began the Tri-County's biggest testing push to date. Testing in the region has so far mostly consisted of day-long mobile testing sites, as well as limited supplies at local clinics and the Big Bend Regional Medical Center. But with hardly a day's notice, SRSU pulled off 2.5 days of back-to-back testing. Working with Governor Abbott, the National Guard, and the Texas Department of Energy Management, Sul Ross opened testing on Thursday afternoon. Within hours, dozens of cars were lined up in the university parking lot. On Friday alone, officials managed to test 341 people. They were just 7 people shy of breaking Friday's statewide testing record, Gallego said, which that day went to a Dallas mobile testing site with 348 tests. By the time testing ended on Saturday, health officials at Sul Ross State University had managed to test more than 750 people. Gallego was thrilled with the results of the initiative, describing it on social media as record-breaking turnout for a small community like Alpine and amazingly fast constituent service on the part of state health officials. Local health workers were also happy with the initiative. Pete Gallego should be commended for making an attempt to get a reasonable amount of testing, said Dr. J.P. Schwartz, the local health authority for Presidio County. The governor has just absolutely abdicated any responsibility. The testing numbers from that 2.5 day blitz, Schwartz noted, were more than has been done in the entire region. That's a heroic thing, he added. I hope they can continue. Locals were less effusive, though, and SRSU officials acknowledged the push faced logistical challenges. On Thursday, the high turnout overwhelmed testing officials, leaving residents waiting in their cars for hours. Some complained of running low on gasoline and needing to use the bathroom, Gallego said. Others left without getting tested. Among them was Brielle Gonzalez, a Marfa resident. As case counts climbed in Marfa, she decided to get tested just to be safe. Gonzalez showed up early for Thursday's testing, thinking she could get ahead of the lines. Instead, it was a total circus, she said. There were around 100 people already in line, she said, and another dozen soon joined the line behind her. Gonzalez waited in line for hours, but I was one of the cutoffs, she added. A testing official came by and said they'd run out of tests. Gonzalez left. Sean Shields, a Terlingua resident, had a similar experience. One of her friends had exposure to a coronavirus patient, Shields said. She wanted to make sure she didn't have the disease. It was so incredibly weird and not organized, Shields said of her experience at the SRSU testing site. And after waiting in line for around 3 hours, she said a National Guard official told her around 4 p.m. that they'd run out of tests. A Sol Ross official said the site was short on time, not tests, and that any report of test shortages were likely a misunderstanding. Hoping to bring better organization, Gallego said on social media on Thursday afternoon that reservations for testing, though not required, were preferred. But with such short notice for the initiative, there was no way to book an appointment through Texas's online testing reservation system, the txcovidtest.org. By Tuesday, the site was down due to appointment availability, according to a statement on the homepage. And meanwhile, the state's phone reservation system, 512-883-2400, was experiencing two-hour wait times, according to a Sol Ross University spokesperson. Then on Friday morning, officials made the abrupt decision to move testing inside the P. Gallego Center. In a social media post that morning, Gallego cited the hot weather and concerns for the safety of National Guard test takers. It also allowed officials to split people into two lines in an effort to speed the process. Still, the changes are also meant that people worried about the coronavirus status were left to congregate not outside in their cars, but inside, in person, where coronavirus can spread more easily. And while officials say they tried to maintain social distancing in the main testing area, people in the line nonetheless crowded together on stairwells. On Friday, another Marfa resident came by with several other residents. He asked not to be named, citing concerns that people might interpret his interest in getting tested as a sign that he was a presumptive patient. When officials abruptly moved testing inside, that group decided to leave. It just felt like they changed the procedure without considering safety protocol, that resident said. Like Gonzalez, he's now hoping to get tested this week in Marfa. Shields, the Terlingua resident, also came by to try again on Friday. She waited in line outside for about an hour, but when the line continued on inside, where she worried she could be further exposed to coronavirus, she decided to once again leave. Shields was angry about the experience. "I'm really mad at myself for walking into that building," she said. She had spent months taking precautions, and she felt her Friday visit to get tested possibly put her at a greater risk than she had experienced through this entire pandemic. Shields was also angry at officials. She questioned why health officials had people congregate inside for coronavirus testing when you don't even let 10 people into the gas station. And she questioned why National Guard testers couldn't stand outside in West Texas weather for a day when some of them had likely served in the Middle East. "I work outside every day in 110-degree weather," she said. "This is Texas, y'all." In his interview, SRSU President Gallego acknowledged that there had been issues with the testing push. "Logistically, an operation this size is always a challenge," he said. And as for the biggest criticism regarding people waiting indoors for testing, Gallego said the National Guard and not SRSU had made the request. The National Guard did not respond by press time to a request for comment about this decision and whether local safety was considered in making it. Last week's scene further reflects the high demand and short supply for testing in the region. Texas has the 7th worst testing rates in the country, even as Governor Greg Abbott has continued with his reopening plans. So far, the main tri-county residents have been able to get tested has been through mobile testing sites that show up once every 1 or 2 weeks. It's a situation Schwartz called sporadic. In a phone call on Tuesday, Schwartz said that the benefits of increasing testing outweigh any issues. "We are so behind on testing. The state has totally dropped the ball," he said. "I don't see anybody but Pete Gallego attempting to do anything about it." He also defended health officials for their decision to move testing inside, noting that heat stroke is a real thing. And while some residents complained of crowding indoors, Schwartz said all residents in that line also had a personal responsibility. "This is like wartime," he said. "The authorities can do a reasonable job as long as they think they can. But with COVID, you've got to take care of yourself." Gonzalez, the Marfa resident, thought the high local demand for testing had added to the chaos. "They thought maybe 20 people would come, maybe," she said. "And the whole county showed up, and they didn't know what to do." Like others who had tried and failed to get tested, she was annoyed with the experience. But when Gonzalez realized the extent that local school officials went to organize the testing push, she was more understanding of the challenges. "I'm glad Saul Ross at least stepped up to do something about it," she said. "It's a step in the right direction." Marfa leaders discuss emergency orders, EMS rates at city council meeting. By Stephen Paulson, June 10th, 2020. Read by Melanie. Marfa. At a virtual city council meeting on Tuesday night, Marfa officials adopted the latest plan for reopening. The ordinance 2020-09 covers a variety of topics from the Marfa municipal pool, which will remain closed, to the gradual reopening of city buildings and services. One of the main issues for debate turned out to be rules governing trash collection rates at short-term rentals. As coronavirus hammered the hotel and short-term rental industry, city leaders allowed short-term rentals, which range from people who occasionally rent out rooms in their homes to commercial entities, to pay residential trash collection rates rather than commercial ones. At the city council meeting, Marfa leaders disagreed on whether such rules should remain in place. "In my opinion, we should stop it," said Mayor Manny Baeza. He noted that the city was paying higher prices for garbage collection and had passed some of those costs onto commercial entities, of which he said short-term rentals were one. Councilmember Raul Lara agreed. "I think we've been quite generous in our billing," he said. Both Buck Johnston and Yosef Ben Yehuda pushed back. "When I originally proposed this, it wasn't my intention for it to be a timed thing," Ben Yehuda said of the revised rules. Instead, he noted that short-term rental owners are one group of people that has been hit particularly hard. He also said that some people only occasionally rent out rooms and are therefore not a commercial entity and likely don't have negative ramifications on the city's housing stock the way a full-fledged one might. Ultimately, the city decided to continue the short-term rental rate abatements through July 10th, at which point, unless the city changes its mind, short-term rentals will revert to commercial rates. At that point, according to the revised rules, short-term rental owners can apply for a waiver to keep their residential rates in place. It remains to be seen what exactly the rules for those waivers will be, though some city leaders proposed using host compliance to determine which short-term rentals are actual businesses versus more casual arrangements. They also want to use the company to track down unregistered short-term rentals. City leaders pegged the number of those at around 30. On the other hand, the city decided to maintain waivers for late fees and penalties related to city utilities. "We can show more leniency," Mayor Baeza said, noting that many people have continued to pay bills. The city also briefly considered whether to further downgrade its color-coded phased reopening from orange to yellow. The system, which works like Homeland Security color-coding system for terrorist threats, will see a further downgrading of precautions once it reaches yellow, including allowing some visitors inside the library and Marfa Visitor Center. Ultimately, though, the city decided to remain at its orange precaution level, which will keep buildings closed. "We do have some staff that are absolutely scared to reopen," said Mandy Roan, the city's director of community services. "A lot of my staff are in high-risk categories." Separately, the city also decided to increase its EMS rates after Bert Lagarde, the city's EMS director, gave a presentation showing that Marfa's EMS rates lagged behind other regional cities. Lagarde said that these rates were letting insurance companies off easy, while city attorney Teresa Todd said the city was subsidizing medical fees that the federal government might otherwise pay for. The changes will see an across-the-board increase for EMS services, with one exception.
Residents will get one free treatment without transport per month. Previously, the city had not charged at all for EMS workers to treat a resident without a transport to the hospital.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, June 18, 2020. Homicide likely linked to earlier shooting by Steve Fountain. The Pecos County Sheriff's Office is investigating a homicide that may be connected to a June 15 drive-by shooting on Main Street in Fort Stockton that left a local man in critical condition. The homicide victim was identified as Randy Lee Clark, 48, of 866 Oriole Lane. The cause of death is pending an autopsy. A person of interest, Christopher Galvan, 30, of Fort Stockton, is in custody at the Midland County Jail on an outstanding warrant. Pecos County Sheriff Cliff Harris said that his department is completing a warrant for Galvan in connection to Clark's death as of the Pioneer Press deadline Wednesday afternoon. Sheriff's deputies and other law enforcement were at Clark's residence well into the evening on June 16. Harris confirmed the case is being treated as a homicide and that there was a very big possibility it was connected to the drive-by shooting a day earlier on Main Street near 3rd Street in downtown Fort Stockton. The downtown shooting saw Adrian Olivas, a 30-year-old Fort Stockton resident, shot multiple times at about 6:14 p.m. on the 300 block of Main Street, according to Fort Stockton police. Olivas was airlifted to MCH Odessa, where he was listed in critical condition. Fort Stockton police have not released a description of the car or possible suspects. No arrests have been reported. The investigation is ongoing, according to police. Residents in the Mesa View area around Oriole Lane told the Pioneer that a small black SUV was ordered towed away by sheriff's officers from a street about three blocks away from Oriole Lane. Police opened to provide FSISD with SROs by Steve Fountain. In the wake of the Fort Stockton ISD school board deadlocking over a plan to create its own police force, Fort Stockton City Manager Frank Rodriguez said that the city's police force remains open to continuing to provide school resource officers to the district's five campuses. The city and school district signed off on a deal where the police would provide the SROs and the district to reimburse the related costs. The agreement was in effect from August 1, 2018 to July 31, 2019. That agreement included a one-year extension unless a written termination was issued. The council approved an agreement at its December 17, 2019 meeting, but it was never approved by the FSISD. At the time, the police had two SROs and were flexing other staff to help at the schools due to shortages in hiring another three SROs, according to minutes from the meetings. Unable to reach a formal agreement for the 2019-2020 school year, the extension was exercised. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic-driven school closures, police stopped providing SROs in March at the request of the district, Rodriguez said. There have been no active discussions with the district regarding the SRO situation since December, Rodriguez said. The city sent the district a letter on May 1st, terminating the original agreement, thus eliminating the window to operate on another extension. Due to the unforeseen COVID-19 crisis, officers that were assigned to SRO have been reassigned to other duties and are no longer assigned as SROs based on the representation from FSISD administration that the SROs would not be utilized while students are not on campus, City Attorney Pooja Boinpalli wrote in the termination letter. Boinpalli ended the letter stating that the city and police department are open to discussing and renegotiating a new SRO agreement, adding that if the district was interested, to please contact her in order to work on a new agreement ahead of the 2020-21 school year. The school board deadlocked 3-3 on a resolution that would have been the first step in creating a police department. About 100 school districts in Texas have their own police forces. Board President Billy Espino was not in attendance, so it is possible that the resolution could be brought back up at the district's June 22nd meeting. Anastasio Dominguez, Tom Ezell, and Andy Rivera voted in favor of the resolution, countered by no votes from Sandra Marquez, Flo Garcia III, and Freddie Martinez. The resolution is a required first step in the process, but would not lock the district into creating its own police force, Superintendent Ralph Trainum told the board, adding that 10 steps are required by the state to complete the process. He said the goal would be to eventually have one officer on each of the five campuses, but that hiring one is all that is needed to start. The resolution included a reference to local law enforcement being limited, and that response time to the school campuses is 7 minutes. Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lujan said that he was not aware of a 7-minute response time, especially with two SROs assigned to the high school that respond immediately. If there was an issue, this was never brought to his attention, said Rodriguez. When asked about the basis for the 7-minute response time in the resolution, Trainum responded via email. It is a required element that is part of the resolution for creating a school police department, Trainum wrote. We looked it up on maps to see what they show as the travel time from Apache to middle school. Lujan said the district's resolution comes as the city is entering its budget process for a fiscal year that starts October 1st. We are open to dialogue with them, Lujan said. They haven't reached out to us. We're in the middle of the planning of the budget for next year. He said the department has absorbed the two SRO positions once they were not needed by the FSISD. Lujan also mentioned that his department will add a new officer on July 15, a process that has taken 3 months from job posting to hiring. He voiced concern about the FSISD being able to recruit, screen, and hire an officer by August. At the June 8 meeting, Trainum responding to a timing question by Rivera said, "I don't think it's undoable." Marquez voiced concern over student safety and alluded to the inability of the district to reach an agreement with the city on the police department providing school resource officers, SROs, on campus. We really need to put all that on the back burner and think about the kids, she said. Trainum and Wolf said there is no animosity toward the city and that the district would continue to work with local enforcement, even with its own police force. There are certain things a cop has to worry about, Demia said. The venue, which over its 5-year run became part landmark, part concert hall, part coffee shop, and part gathering place, the garage, coffee, music, and more, a Fort Stockton business known for hot coffee by day and hot music on weekend nights, announced April 20th that it would not reopen after previously closing due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But the owners wanted to have one final day, so it opened Saturday to serve coffee, teas, and other beverages. At night, it hosted its final concert with Fort Stockton's Snotty Hicks opening for headliner, legendary Nashville artist Bernie Nelson. The played host to an eclectic mix of performers from jazz to country to death metal. Customers could watch a live concert, play pool, and drink coffee simultaneously. A common view shared by those who gathered for the final day was that they just had to stop by, and that they were excited even if it was open for just the one last day. Every time the town gets something good, it disappears, said Darren O'Tierney. It was the only beacon of sanity outside of the hamster wheel. Owners Renee and Brian Gaylor said they might look into using the property to host shows with touring artists and other events, as supporting artists was their main goal in opening the business. Rehearsals for The Miracle Worker. The Fort Stockton Community Theater has begun rehearsals for its production of William Gibson's play, The Miracle Worker. The play will be staged at the new Nelson Street Theater August 7 to 11. It will be the first performance at the new theater, which underwent a $2 million expansion and remodel. The melodrama, The Tragedy of Ragweed Cowboy Joe, was scheduled to be the first production in March, but was pushed back due to the COVID-19 pandemic. It will be staged later this year. The Miracle Worker tells the true story of Annie Sullivan's work in teaching Helen Keller, who was deaf, blind, and mute back in the 19th century. The play was first staged in 1959, 2 years after being performed on television. It was later made into a movie that won 2 Academy Awards in 1962. The FSCT production is being directed by Alice Durskin and assisted by Susan Hall. The cast includes Sadie Hall as Helen Keller, Jordan Ward as Annie Sullivan, Jody Day as Kate Keller, Michael Logan as Captain Keller, Garrett Huckabee as James Keller, Seth Hall as Dr. Agadnos, Anna Nix as Martha, Silas Hall as Percy, Penny Smith as Aunt Ev, and Gail Lampier as Viney. The crew includes J.S. Stroud, Aria Rojas, William Garrison, and Susan Hall. Lights and sound are being coordinated by J.B. Gallegos and Justice Hall. Focus Care sees first COVID-19 case, hospitalization, by Steve Fountain. Pecos County saw its first confirmed COVID-19 case at the Focus Care facility in Fort Stockton and also its first hospitalization due to the virus at Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The resident at Focus Care is a 78-year-old woman who has been assigned case number 34. Her source of contraction is not yet known. She is hospitalized at Odessa Regional Hospital. She was tested at PCMH on June 10. The hospitalization saw a 44-year-old man from Dallas County stay at PCMH for 2 days and one night before being released to self-quarantine in Pecos County. The case has been assigned to Dallas County along with that of the man's 51-year-old brother, who also tested positive and is reportedly quarantining with his brother. According to PCMH CEO Betsy Briscoe, the 44-year-old was screened at the walk-in clinic before being admitted to the hospital due to difficulty breathing. As per protocols, the man was screened and hospitalized in isolation areas and did not pass through non-isolation areas of PCMH's facilities. We took all precautions with PPE, personal protective equipment, and in cleaning the areas, Briscoe said. The man was sent into home quarantine prior to receiving confirmation of his test. Pecos County now has 35 confirmed COVID-19 cases with 5 active and 30 recovered. None of the cases assigned to Pecos County have been hospitalized. The assignment of cases to a county is done at the state level. According to Jesse Dominguez, the county's emergency management coordinator, reported Monday night that Pecos County had tested 671 people with 596 negative tests and 28 tests pending. In addition to the 35 cases assigned to Pecos County, 30 recovered, 5 active, 12 positive tests were conducted in the county, but the patients were assigned to other counties. Of those 12, 9 are recovered and 3 are active. Man found in car died of natural causes. An autopsy performed in Lubbock determined that a man found dead in an abandoned vehicle on June 8 died of natural causes, according to Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander. The man, who had been dead for more than 30 days, has been identified, but the Pioneer has been unable to confirm the man's name and age with police. The body was discovered by two young people in a vacant lot off North Sycamore Street between Dickinson Boulevard and U.S. Highway 285 behind the Atrium Hotel. Police responded to the call at about 8:50 p.m., according to Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lujan. Lujan said the car where the body was found was among several abandoned vehicles in a row behind the Atrium Hotel, and that the vehicles are sometimes occupied by transients. In addition to the vehicles, the lot also had a dump pile containing mattresses, appliances, trees and branches, and other items. The property is owned by the Atrium Hotel. When asked by the Pioneer via tax June 9 if the lot was in violation of any city codes for commercial property, City Manager Frank Rodriguez replied, "We are looking into it and will take all appropriate action necessary."
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, June 18th. City says no personal info obtained during breach. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The City of Monahans' brand new computer network was hit Friday, June 5th, with a ransomware attack attempt, forcing a shutdown of the server system and prompting the city to obtain a forensic investigator. Ransomware is a form of malware in which rogue software code effectively holds a user's computer hostage until a ransom fee is paid. Most attacks are the result of clicking on an infected email attachment or visiting hacked or malicious websites. Quote, "It's not clear just yet how the outside operators were able to get into the city's system, but the initial investigation indicates one of our computers in the water department received an email with a link, and once the link was opened, the hackers were able to access the server and change the password," City Manager Rex Thee said. The new server system was purchased in March for $30,000 from NCOM in Lubbock. At the time, Thee said, quote, "This new server comes with extensive malware and virus protection and will also protect our security cameras," end quote. Once access was given to the server and the password was changed, city employees were blocked from using the correct password to access the server. Quote, as soon as it was realized we could no longer access the server using the password, we shut down everything and unplugged the computers, he said. Online payments were handled by a third-party source, therefore no credit card information is stored within the city's computers. Quote, the only information we store is customer name, phone number, and address, Thee said. Thee then contacted NCOM, who were then able to access the server, and determined there had been a breach. Quote, NCOM officials said it looks as if nothing was done besides blocking the employees from accessing the server, he said. NCOM reloaded the server as if it was brand new, but saved the old information to be further investigated. The preliminary investigation shows no personal information was compromised, but they said, quote, a forensic investigator will come in and examine the old information to be absolutely sure nothing was compromised, end quote. All city employees just completed a cyber training course, and Thies said, quote, more training will be done in the future. Further steps will be taken to ensure that residents' personal information remains safe from any future attempted cyber intrusions. Grand Falls Chamber of Commerce suffers major damage in Monday fire. The Grand Falls Volunteer Fire Department was called to a structure fire in the 100 block of Avenue D Monday night around 10 p.m. According to Roger Mullins, Grand Falls Volunteer Fire Department Assistant Fire Chief, quote, the fire was contained to the kitchen area and in the attic and appeared to be electrical in nature, end quote. No injuries were reported, and the quick response of the fire department saved the structure. Quote, we were able to get there quick and knock it down fast, which saved the building, Mullen said. The inside suffered a lot of smoke and heat damage, and around 90% of the antiques, pictures, and supplies were lost as a result of the fire. It took the men approximately an hour to extinguish the fire, and they used around 15,000 gallons of water. 7 corona cases now documented in Ward County. 7 cases of the COVID-19 virus have now been documented in Ward County, based on information from County Judge Greg Holly. As of Wednesday, 303 tests have been administered in the county, with 6 active cases and 1 being reported as recovered. 5 of the 6 cases are in the same household. As of Tuesday, 87,854 cases have been reported in 238 of the state's 254 counties, with 1,976 deaths. A total of 58,341 have recovered, 67%. Harris County, which contains Houston, has the highest number of cases in Texas, with 17,282 cases and 284 deaths. Dallas County follows with 14,537 cases and 285 deaths. United States totals are 2.18 million reported cases, with 119,000 deaths and 680,000 recoveries. Summer school and meals canceled. According to a news release from Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD, summer school is canceled for Thursday, June 18th, and summer meal distribution is canceled for June 18th and 19th due to an individual being tested at MPW ISD for COVID-19. If the test is negative, summer school and meals will resume on Monday, June 22nd. According to CBS 7 News, Ector County ISD has reported that Odessa High School has suspended their summer strength and conditioning programs for 14 days after an athlete tested positive for the COVID-19 virus. Alpine ISD has closed all summer programs for 14 days after a staffer tested positive. School bond construction activity picking up. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Construction projects throughout Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD are underway, with demolition remodeling activities underway at Walker Junior High, Cullender Kindergarten, and Tatum Elementary. Demolition activities for the Monahans High School campus are set to begin in the next few weeks. Construction of the new elementary school could begin in the next 2 to 3 weeks. The Board of Trustees was updated by architect R.J. Lopez of Park Hill Smith & Cooper, provided updates on projects currently underway. Lee Lewis and Kirk Hewlett of Lee Lewis Construction provided the updates on the plans for the new elementary school during Monday's regular meeting. At Walker Junior High, asbestos abatement, demolition of the office, library, and auditorium has been completed, as well as the demolition of classrooms and locker rooms. Insulation of the ceiling and textured walls has also been completed. Cement for the auditorium and library is scheduled for June 24th. At Cullender and Tatum, asbestos abatement has been completed, and demolition of the office and foyer areas is in progress. Additionally, demolition of the library at Tatum is underway. Asbestos abatement at the high school has also been completed, and demolition will begin soon. The new artificial turfs being installed at the baseball and softball fields is progressing well and is on schedule, Superintendent Chad Smith told the trustees. The cost of the $1.75 million upgrade is being paid from the maintenance and operation budget fund balance and is not part of the 2019 bond money. Quote, bond projects are on schedule and under budget so far, Lopez said. Hewlett told the trustees the bidding process for the new $34 million elementary school had been completed and the construction phase could begin in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Quote, it was a very active bidding process. We received bids from firms in Lubbock, Houston, Midland, Odessa, and Dallas, and the bids came in within budget. Additionally, the bids have several contingencies included for electrical, gas, plumbing, and electronics. We are planning for the worst case to still be on budget, he said. An interlocal agreement between the City of Monahans, Monahans Economic Development Corporation, and MWPISD for the road and infrastructure plans for the new elementary school was tabled until an issue with a pipeline on the east side of the area could be resolved. The proposed agreement calls for the City of Monahans and MEDC to each pay 25% of the cost for the roadways, and MWPISD to be responsible for 50%. Ashley Adotto, director of MEDC and city manager Rex Thee, discussed the proposal. Dean Rasmussen of Maverick Engineering, who is developing the road and infrastructure plans, was also present for the meeting. Rasmussen said a pipeline along the proposed east side will prevent a roadway from being built on top of the pipeline along what is proposed to be Victor Avenue. Rasmussen said, quote, it is totally my fault. I missed the pipeline being there when we did the plans. The oil company has said we cannot put a road over their pipeline, end quote. The issue could dictate changes to the site plan for the elementary school. As such, a special meeting has been called for Monday, June 22nd, to discuss the matter, giving architects an opportunity to review the situation. Trustees present for the meeting were Bobby Almanza, Quint Melius, Donna Garcia, Raymond Reyes, Joel Greiner, and Nancy Upchurch. Trustee Steve Fine was not present.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.